17. Pain and Fear. In preparation for writing these chapters on the DMT sessions, I reviewed every page of my bedside notes. It took a month to look over all of them, cutting and pasting people's reports into various groupings of experience. One of these categories was adverse effects, in which I placed difficult or troublesome responses to DMT. Parts of 25 people's sessions landed in this bin. These adverse effects ranged from being subtle, minor, and extremely brief, to those that were terrifying, dangerous, and lingering. 25 out of 60 volunteers seemed like a lot. At the time, I never sensed that nearly half of our volunteers were having problems. Was I minimizing difficulties in my desire to forge ahead in the research under any and all conditions? This number was even more surprising because I hoped to reduce the incidence of frightening reactions to DMT by studying only normal volunteers with previous psychedelic drug experience. This seemed a safer path than enrolling those who had no idea what to expect or who were already psychologically troubled. Looking more closely at these sessions, it became clear that the vast majority of these problems were, if not especially minor, very brief. This reassured me to some extent. One of the primary reasons I chose DMT as the drug with which to resume clinical psychedelic research was that its effects were so short. I anticipated that no matter how bad things became, at least they wouldn't last too long. The research setting was ripe for the development of negative responses to the drug, and this may have contributed to the high frequency we saw. The clinical environment was quite unpleasant, even though it reassured some research subjects about our ability to respond to medical emergencies. In addition to the actual physical environment of the research center, the research attitude also created a tension that does not normally exist in typical psychedelic settings. The blood drawing, questionnaire administration, and various other experimental manipulations impacted our relationship with the volunteers. We wanted something from them other than just their own psychedelic experience, and that expectation was impossible to ignore. I expected nearly everyone to feel some anxiety as the DMT effects began. I knew many people would find themselves struggling to keep their bearings, especially with the higher doses. My respect for the deeply disruptive properties of DMT made it easier for volunteers to feel understood in their natural apprehension before getting big doses of the spirit molecule. We did our best in attending to such details as smells, gestures, speech, emotional state, and the behavior of everyone in the room. This attention to detail went a long way in protecting our subjects from unnecessarily anxiety-provoking or otherwise disruptive influences. We realized that supportive, caring, and understanding attitudes and responses were the best insurance against serious adverse effects, and the best initial treatment should they emerge. The issue of adverse effects becomes extraordinarily important when we assess the risk-to-benefit ratio in working with psychedelics. Do benefits outweigh risks? Are the negative consequences of psychedelics use worth accepting in light of their positive effects? This chapter addresses the dark side of DMT, while the next looks at how helpful the volunteers' experiences were in the long run. The older research literature hinted at what types of negative reactions we might see with DMT. One of Stefan Zara's subjects for a 1950s DMT EEG study was a female physician. As effects of the intramuscular DMT peaked, she exclaimed, "It is frightening because I cannot terminate it by opening my eyes. How unpleasant! Oh, how bad! It would be better to fall down in a faint. Will it endure still for 1 hour? Give me something so that I shall die quickly. It would be better to die. How were you able to do such?" Zara later summarized the 5 paranoid or delusional reactions in his 30 original volunteers. These subjects reported 1 to 2 days later that they were convinced that someone wanted to kill or poison them during the experiment. DMT was the poison, and the person conducting the experiment was the murderer. One subject became very violent during the experiment and had to be restrained forcibly. Zara's descriptions are unusually forthcoming for a psychiatric researcher. It usually is rather difficult to get a clear sense of what exactly happens during psychedelic drug sessions in the research environment. This is especially common when adverse reactions occur in studies when the research team has a vested interest in demonstrating the drug's beneficial effects. Our New Mexico volunteers' negative reactions to DMT were not qualitatively different from those of volunteers in the other types of sessions about which we've read. They included characteristics of all the previous categories: personal psychological issues, unseen worlds and contact with non-material beings, and near-death and spiritual experiences. What made the effects adverse was not the experience itself, but the volunteers' reaction to it. The subjects' responses to the anxiety-provoking elements subsequently determined whether they'd continue the fearful descent or pull out of it into a more positive resolution. Ida was one of the few volunteers who dropped out of our research after the non-blind low dose. 39 years old when she volunteered for the DMT studies, Ida met my former wife at a woman's spirituality workshop in Albuquerque. She had 3 children and had been unhappily married for nearly most of her adult life. She had a dry sense of humor that seemed to hide a great deal of anger and resentment. It was difficult to relax around her because it wasn't easy to tell if she was laughing with you or at you. She was interested in the DMT research because of her fascination with shamanism. She had taken LSD and psilocybin mushrooms about 20 times in her life, but not once since beginning to raise her family nearly 2 decades previously. Walking into room 531, the afternoon of Ida's non-blind low dose, I was surprised to see her sitting on her bed reading a New Yorker magazine. This was the first and only time a volunteer ever prepared themselves for their first DMT session in this way. She looked nervous. She continued riffling through pages as I gave her my orientation. There was an uneasy tension in the room, and I found myself stuttering my way through my usual speech, which alerted me sooner than did my conscious mind to Ida's intense anxiety. At 4 minutes after the injection, her eyes opened briefly. She looked at me, then quickly looked away. A minute later, she began, "I didn't like it. I didn't like the feeling. My head got real hot. I was out of my body. It was hard to breathe. It's pretty quick, isn't it? For you, maybe. I mean, the onset. Did it seem to last a long time? I was waiting for it to get over with immediately after I started feeling it. I felt the effects while the flush was going in. I couldn't have moved if you'd asked me to. I looked down at my feet and didn't recognize them as my own. It was scary, and I didn't feel safe." There was no way I could give Ida 8 times this dose tomorrow. "Some people just don't like the drug, you know." I hated it. "Let's call it a day and chalk it up to experience. No need to press our luck." "Okay." The kitchen brought her an awful lunch, mystery meat tacos, a fitting end to a difficult session. I called Ida that night. She felt fine, but confirmed her desire never to take DMT again. For some volunteers, their high-dose experiences were powerfully unsettling, and several research subjects dropped out after these sessions. Ken was one of these. 23 years old, Ken had been in Albuquerque only a few months before embarking on our research project. Sporting long, permed hair and a flashy motorcycle, he was one of our more flamboyant volunteers. He moved to New Mexico to obtain training at one of the alternative health colleges, having dropped out of another university because of feeling like a sheep. He had taken MDMA quite often and admitted to having problems limiting his use. He enjoyed the fun, celebration, love, bonding, depth, and spirituality it provided. Curiously, he neglected to answer the drug use questionnaire on the typical psychedelic drugs. I didn't notice that until after he had dropped out of the studies. If I had, it may have alerted me to some misgivings about his experiences on these more powerful drugs. There was something just a little unsettling about Ken. He seemed ever so slightly too cool and new age, and Laura and I both wondered about his shadow side. Where were his edges, his anger, and his boundaries? What really made him tick? He seemed to be flitting through life rather than really taking it in. In retrospect, naturally, this seems to have been the basis for his subsequent difficulties, but there was little way we could have truly predicted his negative response to DMT. Ken's low 0.05 milligrams per kilogram DMT dose went without difficulty. It's a little calming and energizing, like MDMA. There were a few colors. It was pleasant. I wonder how the big dose will be tomorrow. I wasn't sure how he'd hold up the next day, either. In my mind, MDMA is a mild drug. People who prefer it to the typical psychedelics tend not to do well when stressed, either by life or by taking more potent mind-bending drugs. MDMA is what I like to call a love and light drug, one that accentuates the positive and minimizes the negative. If only life were so simple. Ken wore baggy, tie-dyed, thin cotton pants the next day, and a wild psychedelic t-shirt. The nurses at the front desk commented on how cute he was. His breath seemed to catch in his throat as the flush cleared whatever remained of the high dose of DMT from his IV line. Based upon Phillips and other volunteers' reactions to high doses of DMT, this small choking sound almost always was a sign of a powerful effect. Ken's head rocked back and forth, and his feet, involuntarily it seemed, flopped up and down on the bed, as if to discharge the excessive tension he felt. He settled down at about the 5-minute point, but grimaced and shook his head. Within a couple more minutes, he took off his eyeshades and stared straight ahead. His pupils remained large, so Laura and I sat quietly, waiting for him to come down further. At 14 minutes, looking shaken but keeping some composure, he started, "There were two crocodiles on my chest, crushing me, raping me anally. I didn't know if I would survive. At first I thought I was dreaming, having a nightmare. Then I realized it was really happening." I was glad he didn't have the rectal probe in place, this being a screening day. Tears formed in his eyes, but stayed there. "It sounds awful." "It was awful. It's the most scared I've ever been in my life. I wanted to ask to hold your hands, but I was pinned so firmly I couldn't move, and I couldn't speak. Jesus." His experience was over, so there was little advice we could give about letting go or trying to get past his reptilian assailants. He had been stuck, and the most we could do was try and help him accept and maybe even learn something from his session. "What do you make of it?" "I haven't the slightest idea. It was as if I were being punished." He looked directly at me and asked, "Will future doses be this big? I don't think I could do this much again." Ken lay on the bed quietly, absorbing what had just happened to him. He didn't want to talk much, but answered the rating scale without too much difficulty. He was calmer and more composed after eating breakfast. I re-entered room 531 after completing my notes in his chart. He looked refreshed and was waiting for me before leaving the hospital. "How are you feeling now?" "I don't think this is the drug for me. I prefer the mellowness of MDMA. This is too hard and intense." "That's fine. There are other big experiences in store for you in this study. It's a good idea to stop now." I continued to wonder about the content of his horrific encounter. "Do you have any idea why crocodiles came up for you?" "Not really. I like reptiles. I used to own a pet iguana." He laughed. "Maybe it's some sort of Egyptian past life experience." We stayed in touch with Ken. although he soon left Albuquerque and moved to California. His reaction had been so traumatic that I was concerned he might have some permanent psychological damage. We wondered if perhaps he had been sexually molested as a child. He did not recall any such episodes, so this remains speculation. In a way, Ken's session scared him straight. His reptile rape had become a bad memory, one that he rarely thought about, but whose effects continued to ripple outward. He stopped taking any psychoactives, including MDMA, and cut back significantly on his marijuana use. He found work at an herb store and was living with his girlfriend. It could have been a lot worse for him. It's easy with hindsight to relate Ken's negative entity contact experience on a high dose of DMT to his habit of fending off any dark, shadowy aspects of himself. His psychological defenses were just too weak to function under the spirit molecule's powerful influence. While earth-shattering high-dose DMT sessions could turn and stay dark and menacing, some volunteers did a remarkable job of turning them around. For example, Andrea was terrified when the spirit molecule pulled her toward a near-death experience. However, she used her initial fear as a catalyst for some important personal work. Andrea was 33 years old and lived north of Santa Fe with her husband and two children. They were software developers and were quite familiar with mind-altering drugs. She had taken psychedelics over 100 times and had used a lot of cocaine and methamphetamine several years previously. As a child, Andrea began experiencing what we call sleep paralysis and hypnagogic hallucinations. Upon drifting asleep, she would be unable to move and would see brief, frightening visual scenes. Her mother, a strict Catholic, told her it was Satan coming to torture her and that she should pray to Jesus for protection. These frightening experiences continued even now, although rarely. This inability to comfortably drop into the sleep state worried her when she thought of taking DMT at the research center. Perhaps she wouldn't be able to completely relax into the rush of effects. She thought she might have a near-death experience on DMT and wondered about her ability to give up awareness of her body. Despite her concerns, Andrea enjoyed her low dose. She summed up her feelings with her first words, "That was fun." The next day she began by saying, "I woke up this morning with a momentary fear. Then I thought that since things had been so easy yesterday, things would be fine this morning. For some reason, I placed the emergency kit, Valium for panic and nitroglycerin pills for severe high blood pressure, on the blood pressure machine. I couldn't remember when I had ever done that before a high-dose session." Andrea coughed before I had half-finished the DMT injection. She sighed deeply a time or two while the flush was going in. Then she bellowed, "No! No! No!" For the next minute she cried, "No! No! No!" Andrea's legs kicked and flailed. Her husband rested his hand on her leg, gently patting and massaging her. I placed my hand on her other foot. At 2 minutes she was sighing, no longer screaming, and seemed to be settling down a little. I said, "You're doing fine. Just breathe." She replied softly, "Okay." I noticed tears forming under her eye shades at about 4 minutes. "You can cry." She began sobbing, continued for about 5 minutes, and then started relaxing a little. "Did I scream?" "A couple of times." "I thought so. It was hard to let go. There's a lot of feelings in there." She laughed quietly. "I volunteered for this, right?" "Yes. I have your informed consent at home." "I never really left my body. I fought it all the way. I thought I was going to die. I didn't want to die. I was afraid. I realized that I had a body for a reason and that I have work to do in this body." Andrea now turned her fear into a challenge rather than a defeat. "When I was coming down, I wasn't sure if I ever wanted to do this again. But now I think I do. I don't think it will be as scary next time. It was death. I saw myself in that void. The void. It was just black, just too much. I've never had anything like that happen before. On LSD and mushrooms, you can build up to things, and you are still in your body, and you can move in and out of it. With this, you have no choice. I was just totally unprepared and startled and scared. When I returned to the front desk to work on Andrea's chart, several of the ward nurses asked if everything was all right. They were alarmed by the screams coming out of room 531. She got off to a rough start, but she's fine now. Andrea looked pretty good at the 30-minute point, and she filled out her rating scale. Within an hour, she was eating breakfast. How amazing the speed with which DMT hurls us through the abyss and then returns us. When we spoke by phone a day later, she said, "Things I want to do with my life before I die are more clearly defined now. I'm not ready to go yet. We had originally moved to New Mexico so I could go to college, particularly in body work. I got discouraged and never followed through. My life is finite, though, and if I am to go to school, this is the time to do it." Andrea returned for the Tolerance Project the next month. Before getting started, I steered her toward her fear. "Are you afraid of being unconscious? If so, it's all right to black out. You can just pass out. Go for it. You can lose your mind. You will get it back. It'll be all right. 4 doses of DMT will wear you down today. Hopefully, you'll just give up without too much pain and fear." "I'm just worried about where I will go. Will I be all right?" She let out a brief, muffled cry as the first 0.3 milligrams per kilogram dose went in. However, anticipating this, her husband, Laura, and I quickly responded by placing our hands on her arms and legs. She calmed quickly, and throughout the morning she worked on developing the theme that had emerged on her first high dose, a fear of death related to the fear of how to live her life fully. As was the case with so many of our tolerance study volunteers, Andrea broke through into an ecstatic resolution of her anxiety and confusion during her 4th session. 18 minutes into this session, she said, "That was a real gift, this last one. I was in such angst and pain for the first doses, especially the 3rd one, and I thought, oh God, am I going to do this again in this last dose? And I thought, yes, I'll do it again. I just never gave up. And then it was easy. There was literally a flood of being saying, okay, remember when you were young and idealistic and wanted to learn how to do body work? There's no reason I can't do that now." When we spoke by phone later that week, she said, "I am really grateful for the experience. I really wanted to blow things out. It's changed my perspective. It's helped me refocus on my interest in healing work. There is so much I want to do." There was no feeling of, it's all fine. There was no white light during my session. I still have a lot to work on. Part of my joy at the end was a feeling of accomplishment. Andrea could have continued fighting against painful and frightening feelings, making a bad situation worse. We knew she might have difficulty letting go after she told us about her mother's comparing her sleep-related symptoms to demonic attacks. Nevertheless, with her husband's and our support, she continued on through her fear and found the sadness and confusion that lay behind it. Facing her anxiety and fears, giving up resistance, she emerged with a clearer sense of who she was, what she desired, and plans for carrying out her goals. Some of the most immediately hair-raising DMT sessions involved real life-and-death issues related to blood pressure that rose or fell to dangerous levels. Lucas's blood pressure dropped to almost shock-like levels, while Kevin's rose to frighteningly high ones. At 56, Lucas was one of our older volunteers. A writer and entrepreneur, he lived in a remote village in northern New Mexico, where his greenhouse contained all manner of exotic, mind-altering plants. He was articulate, intelligent, and fearless. Lucas's outpatient clinic screening electrocardiogram, ECG tracing, was not 100% normal. His heart rate was rather slow, in the high 50s, and he had what is known as a sinus arrhythmia. This means that when breathing in and out, his heart rate slowed down and sped up more than was the case with most people. I called the cardiologist who interpreted his ECG, and he told me that if Lucas had no signs or symptoms of heart disease, there was little to worry about. It was a normal variant. Lucas's low dose gave us some idea that he might have a big session the next day. Like Rex, who passed out upon entrance to the futuristic beehive, see chapter 14, Lucas also reported a swaying, rocking, slightly dizzy feeling. It feels like the bed is gently rocking, like a hammock swaying back and forth. Part of Lucas's non-blind high-dose session the next day, in which he approached a space station landing bay where he was accompanied by numerous humanoid automatons, is described in chapter 12. Let's now review the more frightening aspects of that morning. Immediately after finishing the injection, Lucas became pale and sighed restlessly. He bent his legs at his knees up and down several times, then looked at Cindy. Jesus Christ! I had no idea what it would do to me. He retched once. I looked around. There was no emesis basin into which he could vomit. Cindy pointed at a gown that was crumpled into a pile behind me. That was all we had, and I offered it to him. He put the gown into his hands and looked at it uncomprehendingly. Huh? Try that, I offered. He retched once into the gown, but did not throw anything up. Jesus Christ. While retching into the gown, he began sliding off the bed head first toward Cindy's feet. I got up, walked over to Cindy's side of the bed, and helped pull him back onto it. He was holding the gown up against his face. At 5 minutes, his blood pressure dropped from 108 over 71 to 81 over 55, and his pulse from 92 to 45. He was pale. In fact, he was turning green. Holding his head and trembling, Lucas was going into shock. 2 minutes later, his pulse was 47, and his blood pressure was 87 over 49. We tried to adjust the bed, to raise his feet and lower his head, to increase blood flow to his brain. In the confusion, it was impossible to operate the controls. Should I call the cardiac emergency team? Get ready some drugs to raise his blood pressure? DMT causes such robust rises in blood pressure that I worried that if his circulation did recover on its own, and we gave him a big dose of adrenaline to treat his shock, we might overshoot and cause a stroke from too high a blood pressure. I said, "You're doing fine. Take some deep breaths. Focus on your breathing." He looked baffled and ill. His vital signs recovered on their own over the next 2 minutes. At 12 minutes, his blood pressure was 102 over 78, and his pulse was 73. At 15 minutes, he began describing his approach to the space station. More relevant to his terror, he described what he saw upon opening his eyes. I looked at Cindy, and she had incredible clown makeup on. It was not funny. It was malevolent. I was afraid to look at her face. I don't really know you, Cindy, but you seem real nice. It was the drug. I had just a flash of you, Rick, like a stainless steel face, with intimations of protuberances and knobs. Cindy was bad enough. I couldn't look at you directly. It would have ruined your bedside manner forever. He started to relax and moved on to excitedly describe his outer space voyage. It was difficult for me to pay attention, thinking about how close to disaster we all had been. His truck broke down on the way home. His wife picked him up, and she spent the drive back to their house describing horrific memories of childhood incest that were emerging in her therapy. Two messages awaited them upon their arrival, A friend had shot his head off in a suicide. Another friend was dying rapidly of cancer. When we spoke the next day, he wondered, "What's real? What's not?" It felt like a boulder was dropped into the pond, not a pebble, and the wake was being felt everywhere. The man who killed himself did so at just about the time I took the DMT. It makes me believe in synchronicity of some sort or another. I had little choice but to tell him, "I've been thinking it would be safest to hold off on any more studies. While I think you're a great person to have in the research, I would hate to damage you physically." Lucas weakly protested, but he understood. Nevertheless, the day's events had seriously rattled him. He asked me to come by to visit him. Later that week, I drove to his house and spent the day with him, the first and only house call for the DMT studies. We went over his session, what had happened, and how he felt about it. By the end of the afternoon, he had somewhat regained his bearings. He felt pretty well within a few days and resumed his normal routine. He attended nearly every one of the post-study socials over the next several years and came to look back appreciatively at his DMT experience. Kevin was 39 years old and married to Sarah, whose story we heard in Chapter 14. He was a rather serious individual, and in his career as a mathematician, he found a certain predictability that suited him. He had taken psychedelics nearly 200 times and found them useful for emotional and spiritual growth. Kevin was a big and burly man, one of those people whose body seems to provide a certain protective role in fending off the outside world. He had a dry wit and a sparkle in his eye, but there seemed to be a certain fearfulness that he spent lots of energy keeping at bay. One of the ways he expended that energy was in being hyperlogical and extremely talkative. Kevin also barely squeezed through the cardiac screening gates to our study. His blood pressure was just below our cutoff point, and his ECG showed some non-specific abnormalities, meaning they did not indicate any particular type of heart disease. Showing tremendous determination to get into the tolerance study, he began exercising regularly, dropped almost 15 pounds, and stopped drinking coffee. He paid for an independent cardiologist examination and an exercise treadmill test, both of which gave him a clean bill of health. His low-dose session was thankfully uneventful, but I worried about his attitude. At 2 minutes after his low dose, he said, "So when does it start? Or is that all there is?" "Oh, I feel some physical effects. My heart's speeding up, and the blood pressure cuff feels odd." He seemed too cavalier. I wanted to shake him up, get him ready for a big trip tomorrow. I felt this even more so when he said Sarah and he were going to have a big meat and cheese pizza and beer with some friends that night. I warned, "I would go into it tomorrow as if you were going to die. Be prepared for that. Approach it with fear, but faith. That's the way that I get prepared for people's sessions when I come into the room. I suggest a lighter meal, too. You really want to be nice to yourself tonight and tomorrow." That next morning, he looked nervous, lying in his bed. Sarah sat near the foot of the bed, ready to offer assistance. He said, "I'm worried about my blood pressure." "So are we, but it should be all right. We've had some pretty high blood pressures, and they resolved quickly." His breathing sped up after the infusion was done, but he remained still. His top blood pressure number, the systolic, shot up to 208 at the 2-minute recording. An alarm I didn't know existed on the blood pressure machine began ringing piercingly. Laura couldn't locate the switch, so she turned off the entire machine. I passed her a note. "Turn it back on at 4 minutes. Let's turn to the notes that Kevin sent us a few days later for his account of what happened. "I feel a tingling in my body, a strange lifting sensation. I see colors coming at me in the darkness. Then I see a light, a matrix of cells that looks like skin under a microscope, with white light behind them. All of a sudden, off to the upper right, I see a figure. She looks like an African war goddess. She is black, carries a spear, a shield, and appears to have a mask on. I've surprised her. She takes a defensive and aggressive posture. She says, "You dare to come here?" I mentally reply, "I guess so." The scene before me erupts in a way that I can only relate to what it looks like in the TV show Star Trek when the spaceship shifts into a faster-than-the-speed-of-light acceleration. I feel a tremendous rush in my chest. My heart is hammering. I feel waves coursing through my body. I think, this is it. Rick and Laura have killed me. Then my subconscious or someone says to me, "You're dying. Don't die." Far away, I hear what sounds like an alarm. I think, something's gone very wrong. I think of Sarah and my little son. I fight. I'm not going to die. I feel as if I've dived off a 10-meter platform, hit the water, and am at the bottom of the pool. I swim for the surface. The effects are wearing off. I am hypersensitive to people in the room. I can hear their breathing and their movements. I feel their tension. My notes indicate that at about 3 minutes, Kevin said, "I'm still here." Good. His 5-minute systolic reading was only 2 points lower, 206, and the alarm went off again. Sarah looked worried. Laura turned to me questioningly. What to do? The situation began hovering near chaos. Is that an alarm? It's okay. Your blood pressure's dropping a little. That was incredible. My bedside notes indicate that as Kevin began speaking, he rubbed the back of his head. His blood pressure continued slowly dropping. He said, "I have a little headache at the base of my neck." His headache most likely resulted from the arteries leading to his brain stretching, but thankfully not tearing, under the assault from his high blood pressure. Kevin then added, "It would be interesting to see if the black woman warrior were there again during the next sessions. Maybe she wouldn't be taken by surprise next time." I thought, next sessions? Kevin's blood pressure was normal by 30 minutes. He was tired but felt good. I knew I had escaped a collision with something very dangerous. I spoke with Kevin later in the day from my office. He sounded upbeat and pressed to continue in the research. "I have had many psychedelic experiences in my life," he said, "but nothing could compare with or prepare me for what happened today. I feel I have come back a changed person. I realized that there are many more realms than the one we exist in. Even though it was terrifying, I am looking forward to participating more. I want to let go next time and see where I go and what I experience. I want to know more about the spaces that I went to." Laura and I conferred about bringing him in for 4.3 milligrams per kilogram doses for the tolerance study. While this was slightly less than the 0.4 milligrams per kilogram high dose, we kept asking ourselves, what if he suffers a stroke? The answer was, of course, we can't take that risk. Kevin was disappointed, but we tried to make the most out of what he had undergone. I said, "You have lots to mull over. You experienced a high dose of DMT, something few people ever do. I probably shouldn't have bent the rules in the first place with your abnormal cardiogram." On the drive home through the mountains at the end of that day, I wondered how the road signs I passed on the highway would have looked if Kevin were dead. Exhausted, I ate dinner listlessly and went directly to bed. Effective screening and preparation was key to keeping serious adverse effects as infrequent as we did. While the rate of negative effects may have been even lower with better screening, it's difficult to see how we could have improved upon our methods. Looking back on it now, one thing I should have done was to trust more deeply my intuition about certain volunteers' psychological suitability or cardiovascular health. Perhaps our doses of DMT were too high. This was a razor's edge. Too small a dose would have fallen short of the psychedelic threshold, but too high a dose, as we saw in Philip's case, as described in the prologue, was dangerous. In retrospect, 0.3 milligrams per kilogram may have been better as our top dose. No one experienced this as sub-psychedelic. We chose 0.4 milligrams per kilogram based upon clinical judgment and our research aims. Nevertheless, this high dose of DMT may have compromised the safety and well-being of the minority of volunteers who lost their way, struggled to find it, and were traumatized in their journey. When all is said and done, the fact remains that the spirit molecule does not always lead us to love and light. It can open our eyes to terrifying realities, too, and mark us with those experiences for as long as do any beatific ones. DMT is a potentially dangerous drug. For that reason, we must think long and hard about using it in ourselves and on one another.